You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
June 2nd, 16th. It is Tuesday, June 16th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Steps and steps, I guess I should have said. On the program today, Barbara Fries, author of Industrial Strength Denial, Eight Stories of Corporations Defending the Indefensible, From the Slave Trade to Climate Change. Meanwhile, Donald Trump edging down, tiptoeing down in polls, particularly in key states. The Judiciary Committee to hear from DOJ whistleblowers on Bill Barr's stone sentencing interference and auto industry intimidation. Meanwhile, English researchers may have found a cheap anti-inflammatory which can reduce death of seriously ill COVID patients. Rate of death, I guess I should say. Congrats to all of us. The federal government lifts its 20-year moratorium on executions. They're bringing them back. Meanwhile, the Fed is going to backstop crappy corporate loans. But for the rest of us, nada. New Yorkers, get your absentee ballot requests in now, as in today, as in right now. Meanwhile, Elliot Engel, fighting off Jamal Bowman, is now taking GOP super PAC-backed money. In Albuquerque, one man shot at a statue protest as the mayor announces the creation of a community safety department. R.I.P. Ilhan Omar's father dies of COVID-19. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. We are here one more day as we are still in semi-lockdown, I guess, depending on what part of the country you're in. Some people are more cautious than others. Certainly, we're still seeing surges across almost a dozen states now in the country. We're waiting on other states. Not going to go away, folks. However, the most likely scenario in terms of, well, there's a couple of scenarios. One is that in some places, people are going to have to go back into some type of lockdown because the curve will be going in the wrong direction. And they will be taxing, if not breaking, their health system in any given state. The other scenario is that people go out, they maintain some measure of responsibility, wearing masks in public, wearing masks, avoiding being inside with other people. I mean, to the extent that we can do that, I mean, that'll work for 5 or 6 months in the northern parts of the country. But after that, we'll see. But the most likely, and then, of course, people are waiting on herd immunity or vaccinations. That is, that's going to take a long time. Vaccinations may never come. We just don't know. However, what people have been really talking about is, as a most likely scenario, the easiest and most achievable scenario is certainly maintaining responsibility with things like masks, things like social distancing, but also to come up with a treatment regimen so that the implications of getting COVID-19, assuming, you know, and I've seen all sorts of estimates on how many people are actually susceptible to getting symptoms of COVID-19. But assuming you're one of those, I think the majority of people, there is some good news coming out of, now this is a non-peer-reviewed study, but it is the... It is a study that had been taking place from the beginning in terms of providing treatment, not the beginning of, but in the course of treating people. It's not looking back on it. It is a conscious study that was being done in Britain. Dexamethasone, a cheap corticosteroid, which I guess has been around for about 60 years. It's an anti-inflammatory. Greatly reduced rates for people on respiratory support, 35% for ventilator, 20% for those who are in oxygen tanks. This is a randomized trial. So it's an actual study. Hasn't been peer-reviewed, but it is the first drug to improve survival. Remdesivir, if maybe I'm mispronouncing that, supposedly will speed up recovery. But for folks who are seriously ill with COVID, this anti-inflammatory seems to help. And so it's not something that people anticipate. I mean, look, inevitably people are going to hoard these things, but it's stupid because it doesn't help you unless you've already gotten it and it's already in it and it is impacting you severely. Anecdotally, a friend of mine who is on immunosuppressants told me that recently their doctor told them that the immunosuppressants, while it makes them more susceptible to catching COVID-19, it can save their lives because one of the sort of bizarre things, I guess, about this coronavirus is that it creates a, Brendan, help me out here, a cytokine storm.
Yes.
A cytokine storm, which is essentially your immune system begins attacking so violently the virus that it ends up hurting other, it ends up like hurting the host, essentially. So the suppression of the immune system actually keeps your body from attacking you too much. So that's good news. You know, we're going to obviously need to see it peer-reviewed and more, but there's a lot of people who seem to be very excited about this, basically because it's coming out of a reputable situation and it was a randomized trial, et cetera, et cetera. So nice to bring some good news. That's two good stories in 2 days. We'll talk more about the Supreme Court ruling later in the program. Folks, I think people out there know their relationship to their pets, particularly in this situation, how deep it can be. I'm going through this with my cat as diabetes, and it's I'm more emotional about it than I thought I would be, just because he's slow and his brother is upset and et cetera, et cetera. But folks feel this way, cats, particularly dogs. I'm more of a dog person, but that wasn't my choice. You know, we can't always control these things. Well, Embark's breed and health test is the best way to take care of your dog. It's the best way to get a sense of who your dog is. It gives you full read on breed traits to genetic risk factors. Of course, those genetic risk factors can give you a heads up on what kind of health conditions your dog may have now or in the future. Embark provides the resources to help you and your vet best tailor things like diet and health regimens. Over 50% of dogs apparently are at risk or either at risk or either a carrier for genetic disease. Embark, of course, will help you learn their health history and, in some respects, their health future. It's developed by PhDs and vets. It's the number one trusted source for breed detection and accuracy. I don't have a dog, like I say, but Kelly, former producer Kelly, dog Edie, she used to talk about a lot. Well, she got Embark for Edie. And she said, I received Edie's results from Embark, and there's so much information about her. She tested clear for all 175 genetic health conditions they screened for. She's not a carrier or at risk for any of the genetic diseases they test. There's also a full clinical trait report. So much great news, but more importantly, I can provide the vet the report to her vet, which will provide so much information to help with Edie's health as she grows up. We've heard from listeners. I've seen people super excited about Embark, both of what they learned about their dog and the fact that they are sure that they're providing the best diet and the best care for their dog because they want their dogs to be around for as long as possible. This summer, Embark has a limited time offer just for our listeners. You can go to EmbarkVet.com now. Use promo code MAJORITY. You get $50 off your dog breed and health kit. Visit EmbarkVet.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY to get $50 off today. Check it out, folks. You'll be glad you did for you and your vet. All right. Let's before we get to Barbara Fries, our guest, let's just hear Donald Trump respond to in many respects, I mean, I don't know if it was total, it was a surprise. Ian Millhiser had sort of predicted and read the tea leaves in some of what Gorsuch apparently had asked during the moot hearings. I mean, not the moot, the oral hearings on this case. But as you know, the Supreme Court ruled that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, in terms of employers cannot discriminate for race, religion, or sex, was found to also protect folks who are LGBT from discrimination at the workplace. And the argument essentially was, and I'll go into this a little bit later, we may have a guest on tomorrow to go through it a little more, is that Gorsuch is a what they call a textualist, says you can't discriminate based upon sex. And his argument is, if you would allow a woman, if you cannot discriminate against a woman because she's dating a man, then you cannot discriminate against a man because he is dating a man. I mean, to put it very simply, because that is contingent upon the employee's sex. And you're not allowed to discriminate on that basis. That's the long and short of it. Here is Donald Trump responding to this. Now, remember, he is, this is painful for him because there's a lot of evangelicals out there who still want to be able to discriminate against gay people in the workplace. They may get their wish in the context of religious setting, but in terms of a secular workplace, no, sir. Here's Donald Trump.
Let's start with counsel.
Go ahead, please.
Do you have any reaction to the Supreme Court decisions earlier today about LGBT discrimination, saying that's protected under the Civil Rights Act?
No, they've ruled. I've read the decision, and some people were surprised, but they've ruled, and we live with their decision. That's what it's all about. We live with the decision of the Supreme Court. Very powerful. A very powerful decision, actually. If they have so ruled.
They have so ruled. Very powerful decision. I really wonder if he knows what it is. Do you guys think he understands what's going on with it? Or is he just knows like this is going to be bad for the Bible people?
He's given more prompts like, can you characterize it for us? Not like what think about it and what adjective you'd like to apply to it.
Mm-hmm. That is so annoying. Reporters never ask him anything that is specific. Like you would think at this point that they would have figured out how to ask a question that just sort of like forces him to respond with something as opposed to like good, bad, big, you know, heard a lot about it. Like something to the effect of like, what changes do you think this is going to bring about? Could be many changes, could be big changes, I suppose he could respond. But at least it makes him look more ridiculous in that respect. But there it is. There's your good news. Hang on to that piece of good news, folks, because we're going to get more rulings over the next week or two. And I don't, I suspect they're not going to be nearly as good. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Barbara Fries, author of Industrial Strength Denial, 8 Stories of Corporations Defending the Indefensible from the Slave Trade to Climate Change. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back. Sam Cedar, Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to the program environmental attorney Barbara Fries. She is the author of Industrial Strength Denial, 8 Stories of Corporations Defending the Indefensible from the Slave Trade to Climate Change. Barbara, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right. So I want to just start with, I guess, what was sort of the beginning of your road of this journey that you have taken through writing your first book about coal, but into the machinations that allowed coal executives, and then ultimately you looked into 7 other industries to do what they do. I think folks who are longtime listeners know that I go twice a year to a mass tort conference where I interview all sorts of tort attorneys, and I ask them the question that I think you have answered, at least to the extent that one can in your book, which is like, how do these people justify making these decisions? You know, after you hear that, you know, what emails were found in discovery or whatnot, but first tell us about that cross-examination that you had of coal industry executives. Back, I guess it was in the late 90s, you were working for, I think it was the state of Minnesota, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And give us the context of that, because, and also even the change in legislation, the statutory change that changed how you calculated, you know, what coal was, you know, whether, you know, what the standards for the use of coal were.
Right, sure. So, yeah, I was an assistant attorney general for the state of Minnesota, which meant that I was basically a line attorney working for the state and representing our pollution control agency. Minnesota had passed a law that that required our public utility regulators to try to calculate in dollars the cost to the environment of generating electricity. So this was really just intended to be some information that would help with energy planning, because, of course, public utility regulators play a big role in deciding whether utilities should be investing money in coal plants or other forms of electricity. So this was an early attempt to try to get at that issue and to do it in a science-based way. And it led to this enormous proceeding in the state of Minnesota. This was actually 1995, I think, when we had the hearings. And all the utilities in the state were parties, and we looked at all of the different pollutants coming from coal plants, including CO2 and climate change. And this was still relatively early for states to be getting involved in that issue from a policy perspective. And it really did freak out the coal industry. And they sent many witnesses to testify. And these were scientists, actually, the ones that I cross-examined, not executives, although the executives were obviously supporting their testimony. And they came to essentially tell us in Minnesota that even though the world had already entered into a global treaty to try to fight climate change, and that there was already enormous evidence that this was a genuine threat, they basically came to tell us that we really did not need to worry about it, that it wasn't going to happen, or if it did happen, it would be mild and we'd enjoy it because we're a cold state. And that all those other scientists who were, on whose work the world was mobilizing at that point, that they were basically biased and we should discount their views. And so that was pretty shocking. And it led me to, among other things, write my first book, Coal, A Human History, which was sparked in part by that. And then over the years, I did additional work trying to prevent the construction of new coal plants, trying to get in place climate laws, worked for the Union of Concerned Scientists. And in the context of this, ended up facing, you know, a lot more climate denial and saw it sort of spreading through history, or rather spreading through society. But like you, my initial question in the mid-90s kept recurring, which was, how can they be saying these things when there is so much evidence and so much danger? And I started thinking of this as a social phenomenon, which, you know, shouldn't be a big surprise to anyone. But once you really start thinking of it that way, rather than what's wrong with this individual, then you start to ask, well, where else has this phenomenon taken society in the past? And how precisely did industries actually justify what they were doing and when confronted with this really compelling evidence? And how did societies overcome that if they did? And so that was what prompted me to start really digging through the archives.
Okay, so now there's a lot of stuff here, and so that I want to go through. But let's and because when we talk about it as a social phenomenon, right? We're talking about it as a social phenomenon in the context of corporations, as a society in and of itself, and then also a social phenomenon in a broader context. And certainly, we see that at the very least. We see it with particularly when it comes to global warming, right? Because that is sort of like the denial sort of, I don't know that it escaped the bottle. I think it was, it was sort of like poured on society as part of a tactic in some way. And so I want to just stay for a moment in terms of tactics, because, I know that the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel energy, or I should say the fossil fuel industry, has borrowed a lot of tactics that were developed by the tobacco industry. That was that denial is almost like it's being a little bit generous, right? In the context of that, but the denial. Go ahead.
If you take the narrow psychological definition of denial, it's being generous. And I do try to use the term more broadly to include both what we might consider psychological denial and just straight up from a legal perspective, denying that something exists.
Okay. So, let's isolate for a moment, because one of the other industries you looked at was tobacco. Let's just talk about the sort of the similarities. How much of, I imagine the denial takes place there maybe, for these industry executives who are smoking cigarettes during, as they're sitting in the boardroom. But then they basically try and manufacture a psychological denial for a greater community. What tactics did they use that were sort of like consciously adopted from the oil industry or fossil fuels from the tobacco industry? And has there been any other sort of like instances that you found where tactics sort of consciously were adopted?
Well, certainly one of the tactics that was adopted was the use of front groups. That was something that the tobacco industry did a lot, still does, trying to put their arguments into the mouths of other parties who would sound more credible. And certainly we saw that and continue to see that with the fossil fuel industry. By the way, my climate denial chapter is not just about coal, but about the whole fossil fuel industry and the various groups that they fund. Another enormously important tactic that they use is simply around the burden of proof. If you keep the burden of proof on those alleging danger, then by definition, the benefit of the doubt goes to those on the other side. It goes to the industry. And once you have the benefit of the doubt, you have a profound incentive to always exaggerate the doubt. And that's really easy to do. And when you do that, you essentially create enough confusion that allows you to block any government action. So that dynamic was clearly present with the tobacco companies, still is, and has certainly been used by the fossil fuel industry. Another thing we saw a lot with the tobacco companies was trying to exalt their own motives so that instead of saying, you know, we're here to sell a product and make a lot of money, they would cast themselves as essentially the defenders of freedom, often casting their opponents as fascists and sort of entering into this tribal mindset where they're the heroes, their opponents are absolutely the enemies. Excuse me, and the system is rigged against them. So that's certainly something we've seen the fossil fuel industry do as well. In the case of fossil fuel, ironically, instead of just saying that they're defending free enterprise, which many of the industries have done, they're arguing that they are defending Americans against the sinister elite, and that gets kind of strange because you end up with, you know, billionaires and oil companies funding arguments that are meant to persuade folks on the economically lower side of the scale to distrust those at the top by using this term elite. But of course, they're using it to disparage the mainstream scientists who are spending their lives studying this and really have the expertise.
This may be outside your portfolio, or maybe not, but I mean, everything you just said, particularly like in that description, I feel like could apply to, 75% of the stories about, what's going on with coronavirus right now. And frankly, you know, what's going on even with stuff like, you know, the supposed free speech that many on the right feel that they're being denied, like this dynamic of aggrievement and, whatever product they're selling. And just like, I'm just asking questions, right? Like I'm just putting right. doubt out there. I mean, what's downstream from what in that?
Well, I can tell you with climate change, I mean, it clearly, in terms of climate denial, that clearly began with the industry. And I was there in the 90s when they were really getting this cranked up and sent it out and through these front groups, through right-wing media, and then into the Republican Party, and then finally took it over. And that was a really dramatic change. But, I mean, you're certainly right that these kinds of dynamics of denial and tribalism appear again and again in lots of different contexts. It's just that in the industrial context, in the corporate context, you have all of these factors that promote denial, plus you have this powerful financial incentive, and you've got this ideology that basically says that the invisible hand will make sure that if you pursue your self-interest, it will automatically lead to the public's interest and then more recently, in its more extreme forms, that any government interference with the marketplace is inherently evil. So, yeah, I mean, what we see in industrial strength denial is a lot of dynamics that seem particularly familiar right now as our nation is engaged in these very, very tribal conflicts over issues that often have a very clear scientific basis to them, or an emerging one in the case of COVID, because, of course, we're learning things very quickly.
I want to get into more sort of like the broad methodologies, if you will, of denial and how they maybe in the various industries that they manifest themselves in the various industries you looked at. But one thing that occurs to me is that, you know, in terms of climate change, years ago, maybe it was about 10 years ago, I was on a panel with Christine Todd Whitman, who was the former EPA, I think under George, maybe it was George W. Bush. Her response at one point, she said, you know, if the left and the liberals, which is what they referred to the left at that time, if the liberals weren't so animated about pushing climate change, maybe folks on the right would be more responsive to it. Like that dynamic, I just found fascinating that there was almost it's the critics' fault that make it so hard for us to sort of lose our denial on some level. And I wonder if that, you know, if that wasn't a dynamic that you came across in the course of looking at these things, that like maybe if people weren't so, you know, so overly worried about how much cancer they could get from cigarettes, we would be more willing to look at it or something like that. I mean, is there anything like that you came across?
You know, I don't think I can actually point to one. I mean, in the great panoply of different kinds of denials, that's kind of a unique one, and certainly not something that I think that the history of any of these campaigns of denial would support. On the contrary, the ability of the industry to remain complacent and denial and deny the harms they're causing seems to be almost endless, and it seems like the only way to get it to be confronted by society is for outsiders to raise the alarm and keep doing it.
You know, I wonder though, as I say it now, if that isn't just a tribalism, a mechanism in which to enhance tribalism, and then the tribalism itself does the rest of the work. I mean, talk about tribalism in this context, because this is what you identify as a big driver of denial. How does tribalism manifest itself in the context of, like, I don't know, selling unsafe cars?
Well, it manifests itself in every one of these chapters, and that's in part because we have evolved minds that are so immediately divided into us versus them, even when there's really not much at stake. It just automatically happens, and neuroscientific research is showing how immediately it affects the way that we look at the world in terms of both of deciding what we believe to be factually true and certainly deciding what we believe to be morally correct. And so generally speaking, the way tribalism unfolds is that you've got somebody outside an industry who is showing up with some evidence that this industry is causing harm. Now, the people within that industry are very automatically and by human nature going to get defensive, and especially if they're not feeling guilty, and they're probably not feeling guilty about it because they didn't intend to hurt anybody. And they will start immediately being suspicious that their critics have an ulterior motive beyond just addressing the issue. So they'll start accusing their critics of having that ulterior motive. Maybe they're greedy. Maybe they just want attention. Maybe they're zealots of some sinister cause. At the same time, they'll start elevating their own role in making the world a wonderful place beyond, you know, just selling the product that they're selling. And before very long, if the public opinion starts changing against them, they will start to complain of a witch hunt, of lynching. They will claim the system is rigged. Once they start feeling that the world isn't fair to them, then that, of course, justifies all kinds of blatantly deceptive things like using front groups and whatnot. So I think that's the general pattern that plays out. In terms of the auto industry, they, of course, were, you know, they were at the top of the world after World War II. They were, some of the biggest companies in the world. They the United States was really redesigning itself around automobiles. But there were so many crashes, so many people dying, and it was a very visible problem. The way they handled it was basically to say, that it's to keep the focus not on the cause of the injury, but the cause of the accident. And the cause of the accident, they could almost always claim, was bad drivers, people with bad attitudes, maybe sometimes bad roads. So that was the government's problem. So a big shift there was to get people to start looking at what actually kills folks. Flying through the windshield, for example, or smashing into a dashboard with all kinds of sharp and pointy things on it. And when people from the outside tried to say, like doctors who would show up and say, see how this patient's facial gash accurately reflects this dashboard feature, you know, you should change your dashboards. The auto industry was outraged. They didn't think those people had any business telling them how to design their cars. And of course, that became quite public when Ralph Nader came along and tried to suggest that there were certain ways to redesign their cars. You know, they were just at the very top of the world, and they thought it was audacity for anybody from outside of their tribe to suggest that they were doing something wrong or had a responsibility to protect the drivers who inevitably crashed in millions of crashes, even if they were good drivers, or even if they were bad drivers, they still didn't necessarily deserve to fly through their windshield.
Let's talk a little bit about, I want to definitely hit the leaded gasoline and investment products, because these are sort of, you know, like the level of knowledge that I think was involved here, at least in terms of leaded gasoline, as to the dangers of leaded gasoline, it's sort of astonishing in a way. I mean, will you tell us a story of leaded gasoline? Because I have some familiarity with this, as far as I remember, the guy who invented it was like, hey, wait a second, this could be a problem. right? I mean,
more than that. Yeah. I mean, basically GM was working on trying to make cars more powerful. And in the 1920s, cars had a problem with knocking, and they wanted to be able to make bigger engines. And so they wanted to solve the knocking problem. And one of their chemists figured out that if you put a little bit of this lead-based chemical, lead tetraethyl, they called it, into the gasoline, the knocking went away. So that was pretty cool, and they were very excited about it. But this was lead, and people had known since antiquity that lead affects the mind. And it was by then already the most conspicuous industrial poison, and people knew that it built up in the body, and people got lead poisoning. So when the news that they were going to do this got out, they got a lot of pushback from public health experts in academia. They got a letter from the Surgeon General saying, you know, in this sort of very polite fashion, since we know this is a poison and it builds up from lots of tiny, tiny exposures over time, is this really such a good idea? And basically the scientists for GM wrote back and said, well, we haven't really tested this. We don't really have any evidence, but we don't think it will be detectable. So it's this kind of, you know, if you can't see it, it's going to be fine sort of situation. And this ended up in the newspapers because there was a very spectacular series of poisonings at one of the plants making tetraethyl lead right outside of New York City, a Standard Oil plant. And people suffered there from what was referred to as violent insanity from being exposed to the gas, to the product put into the gasoline. This is not what comes out of the tailpipe later. But that got a lot of attention to this issue of putting lead in the gasoline. There were big conferences, well, one big conference, frankly, that the Surgeon General held, brought in the industry, brought in the public health authorities, and the industry basically said, first of all, they got up and said, hey, we have no bias on this issue. And if you suggest otherwise, you're insulting us. And we are, that it's actually men of medicine who work for the company who are controlling this issue. And if they see any evidence showing a real harm, we'll take this out immediately. And basically the conference ended up saying, well, okay, we don't really have evidence to shut you down right now, but it's really important that we keep track of this issue, that we watch it over time. Congress should appropriate money to study this over time. Well, the only groups that actually studied this over time was the actual industry making the leaded gasoline. Mm-hmm. They ended up dominating the research. And of course, they never found a problem. And they ultimately had a theory that was quite dominant, that having a certain amount of lead, a very high amount of lead in your body, was perfectly natural and perfectly harmless until you crossed a line and suddenly you had clinical poisoning. So, you know, this was in the 1920s. And so much was known, so much was predicted. Then the issue was ignored for 40 years until the 1960s, when a scientist actually trying to figure out the age of the Earth, a geochemist, was studying lead levels and realized, yeah, lead is everywhere, but not because it's natural. Lead is everywhere since we put it in our fuel. And before that, it wasn't everywhere, and made it obvious that we had, in fact, created this low-level poisoning of pretty much the whole world, pretty much generations of people, which affected not just the development of all of us, pretty much all of us born before 1980, but in fact continues to have impacts on adults who were exposed to lead in childhood.
I mean, there's a sufficient, I mean, I don't know if it's sufficient, but there is a body of evidence that the reduction in crime that we've seen nationally and internationally is a function of essentially outlawing lead in gas.
Yes, that's a really interesting theory, and there is evidence. I find it very interesting. There is, I've seen one study finding otherwise, and I didn't feel competent to resolve those studies. So I hope we continue to look into this. But we do know that lead not only diminishes IQ, but makes it harder for people, made it harder for kids to function in school, made it more likely that they would end up in trouble with the law, was associated with anger issues. So it really should not be any big surprise if some of that crime wave that has been diminishing since the 90s was in fact related to having poisoned generations of people.
All right, let's talk about the investment products that led to the financial crash in 08. I mean, I think there's a decent, just today, I guess, the Fed, or yesterday, the Fed announced that it was going to back corporate bonds, essentially corporate loans. There is a real concern that there is this sort of animal out there, financial instrument, collateralized loan obligations as opposed to debt obligations. It was the CDOs that, you know, many people say did us in the financial crisis. And that there is a similar sort of securitization of really bad corporate loans that are out there. Fed stepping in right now. I don't think that's a coincidence. But give us a sense, because I'm really curious. I mean, one of the things that, I mean, let's, in the context of the financial crisis, I mean, I know that there's like sort of an arrogance that a lot of these folks had, and that they just thought, well, I think it ranges from like, I know what I'm doing, you don't. It's too complicated for lay people to understand, to like, I know I'm going to make money and I don't care what happens beyond that. But also, I guess I'm really just curious. I know there's, you know, situations in discovery where you find like people are very aware of the consequences. They know that things could turn horrible and they still sort of justify it to themselves. Talk about that in context of the 08 crash.
Sure. By the way, I do want to stress that in almost all of my chapters, I'm focusing largely on public denials, because I think it has a really important impact on, you know, the social norms around how we understand truth. You know, I think it's corrosive in ways that just hiding a secret in your secret documents isn't. But we do have some documents from the financial crisis that give you an idea of some of the things that were going on behind the scenes in their minds. Certainly, you know, there was denial about the fact that there was a housing bubble, denial about the fact that there were these ridiculously low and dangerous lending standards, denial about the ability to take really risky subprime loans and turn them into investment products that were supposed to be safe. But I think one of the biggest and most important areas of denial associated with the financial industry was simply their denial that they needed to be regulated. this notion that somehow they could manage risk themselves and in the public interest. And that is how we ended up deregulating that industry, taking apart the Depression era regulations. And that is what blocked us from regulating derivatives, even though people knew that they were incredibly complicated and nobody really understood them, and therefore they were dangerous. And then, of course, there was just this really general sense that it is fine to exploit people, that, you know, sort of celebrated greed and argued that people who made ridiculous sums of money really deserved it because, well, I guess because they could get it. And so those are all the areas of denial that I discuss in that chapter.
When we talk about public denial, just talk, I guess broadly, what does that do to society? I mean, is part of the sort of real, I guess, degradation of folks' trust in institutions a function of that?
Absolutely, yeah, and in fact, that's one of the arguments that I make. I mean, you can sort of see it if you look at what happened with ozone, and I'll just try to talk about this very quickly. We had a crisis. There were years and years of denial. Eventually, we had an ozone hole. It became obvious what was going on. Chemical industry decided to shift. They could make the substitutes anyway. So we had global scientific assessment groups, scientists brought together under government auspices, working together, and we put together a treaty, and we essentially solved the problem. Ozone is still healing, but it was a big success. But you had immediately after that a backlash against all the institutions that led to that success. You had the rise of this very anti-government libertarian streak, and you had multiple industries, including the tobacco industry and including the climate, the fossil fuel industries, funding organizations that would then challenge the science, go back and challenge the science about ozone, even though that was settled, that would challenge the science, of course, around tobacco, and that would, I think, most consequentially, challenge the science around climate. And they would then send these messages out through cable news, right-wing radio, and ultimately, of course, through social media. But you know, the approach of trying to undermine the credibility of government, of academia, of the entire scientific establishment, and certainly of media, left people with nothing left that they could trust to figure out what's true and what isn't when you're talking about science. And that left them extremely vulnerable to people who wanted to appeal to their pre-existing tribal biases or to their resentments, and of course to politicians who are supremely skilled at doing that.
It occurs to me that at one point the you have some executives who say, you know, all we need is to put enough science out there to refute it, to just to create this cloud of doubt and have people go like, I'm not a scientist, I don't know what to believe, essentially. And
right.
And it sort of feels like in the past, I don't know, 5-10 years, that's what's been going on society wide. Like there is, like, it's not just limited to the question of science, although we're definitely seeing that in the context of COVID, right? I mean, people are just the administration is putting out, to the extent that it's putting out anything, a bunch of different, hydroxy and et cetera, et cetera. But also just more broadly speaking, like, I've had conversations over the past 5 or 10 years with people who are like, well, you have your facts and I have my facts. And it seems like this has been, it feels like it's sort of emanated from these corporate projects that, go ahead.
I certainly think they contributed to it. I mean, it turns out that societal trust is easier to destroy than I would have guessed. And certainly you see these industries doing this. I mean, back in 1986, I think it was, the Tobacco Institute, and the tobacco industry by then was already, you know, the poster child of scientific bias. Nobody took them seriously, and they knew nobody took them seriously. But they ended up issuing a report calling for the investigation of the Surgeon General for censorship of science, and said that scientific integrity was at stake. Now, nobody ended up after that thinking, oh, I guess we can trust the Tobacco Institute for scientific integrity. But they didn't need to. All they needed to do was build doubt about the Surgeon General and just sort of distrust building is what I call it in the book. I think that was something they consciously attempted to do and proved to be incredibly successful. And you're right, it doesn't just apply to scientific issues. It applies to our entire sort of post-truth era, and it applied to, you know, weapons of mass destruction and the size of your inauguration crowd, right, and a lot of other things.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Barbara Fries, the book is Industrial Strength Denial, 8 stories of corporations defending the indefensible, from the slave trade to climate change. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. I'm going to take a break in a moment, head into the fun half of the program. I got a really nice email, and I forgot to pull it about our masks. And somebody wrote in. It was very gratifying. I got to be honest with you, because they said that. Well, I'm going to paraphrase. And people are just going to have to trust me without having the exact verbiage here. Let me see. Wait a second. Maybe I can find it right here. Well, I can't find it. But it was basically like, wore your masks to a somewhere where they were. And it caused other people to remember to put their masks on as they showed up. Because our masks, of course, are borrowed. And I should say, I got corrected on this. Because I'm old, I keep saying Czechoslovakia as opposed to the Czech Republic. But in the Czech Republic, apparently their slogan was, your mask protects me, my mask protects you. That's what our masks say at the Majority Report merch shop. We've got other stuff there. We got, Best of Left t-shirts and hoodies and mugs. And we're going to roll out some other designs soon. But all the masks, all the proceeds go to Pacific Northwest Immigration Services. And so you can check that out. Go to shop.majorityreportradio.com. Also, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member, you support the free show, and then we give you extra content every day, and you get the free show commercial free. So we need some members. We went through a big period of demonetization with on YouTube. That's a source of our revenue. So if you are in a position to support the program, join the majorityreport.com. Much appreciated. If you are not, we're not going to lock anybody out for financial reasons. You can send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will take care of it. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And sign up for the AM Quickie. We're going to start putting notifications on the AM Quickie soon. So check that out. Today is Tuesday. Matt, do you know what's going on TMBS tonight?
Yeah, Noam Chomsky's going to stop by, so we'll have an interview with him for every night.
Noam Chomsky, is he going to stop by?
It's not on to be over the internet. He's not traveling to New York.
I hope they're not relying on your internet, buddy, because yours is cutting in and out right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Send an email to Noam Chomsky, ask him about your internet. Apparently, that's what everybody's doing now. Because there's nothing more that we want is, one of the foremost intellectuals of our day to have to write back email questions on like I've got a bet with my, what's better? I don't know, chocolate or butterscotch pudding or something. I don't know. People are doing that. But check it out tonight at TMBS. See it on YouTube at youtube.com/TheMichaelBrooks Show or patreon.com/TMBS. And joining us for the fun half today will be Nomi Konst.
Hello.
And what's happening on your show, Nomi?
So even though we are in the same city as the Noam Chomsky, fun fact, we were going to do a live in-person interview in Tucson together, but COVID hit. So that was put off. So Michael just, you know, scooped me sort of like no one's ever interviewed Chomsky before. No. But it's great. He teaches at University of Arizona, a very fine institution. So on this week's show, we have Cori Bush, who is a congressional candidate and activist out of Ferguson. It is a must-see interview. I think she is, if not already, she's becoming one of the leading voices of our generation. She brought me to tears during the interview. She's really gone through quite a bit running for office. Wow. Last time and this time. We have Jennifer Cohn, who talks about, she's an election integrity advocate. She talks about what happened in Georgia, about these machines, which is, I think that we all need to like talk a little bit more about how the two voting machine companies that we use in America are both owned by Republicans, and several states, including Democratic states, are using them, and they're just faulty, and there's no oversight. And that has a lot to do with what happened in Georgia. And then we talked to Lauren Ashcraft, who is running for Congress against Carolyn Maloney in New York's 12th district, which is my district, actually. But she is running against an institution. This is one of the wealthiest districts in the country with, I think, the second highest income inequality in the country. So you definitely want to hear that because the primary is coming up on June 23rd.
That's right. Just a reminder, if you're in New York, you can go online right now. You got to Google wherever county you're in or New York City. You can get an online application for an absentee ballot. All you need to do is put in temporary illness. I think actually on the online version, it has parens. You can use this for COVID. Temporary illness. They will send you a ballot, but you have to do this today.
Today, yes.
And we got very important races, primaries all across the state. Ashcraft's primary, Bowman's primary. We're going to talk about Elliot Engel and AOC's primary. Oh, we should also say, incidentally, on Friday, we're going to be hosting AOC on this program.
What?
Yes, that's right.
Breaking news.
That is breaking news.
Wait, can I be on Friday?
Here we go.
Get out.
Well, I should have done it over the thing. But so there, that's a little bonus for you folks who listen to the end of the free show on Friday. I'm very excited about it. We'll talk more about that in the fun half. Also, folks, check out the Antifada. Jamie had like 12 different things that were going on with that show this week. So they should check that out. Theantifada.com, patreon.com. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Matt, what's going on the Literary Hangover Twitch stream?
One thing, pirates. Twitch.tv/Literary Hangover. We're talking about pirates, John Paul Jones, American privateers, the American Revolution, that sort of thing.
If you have kids out there, here's a good kid joke. do you know what the pirate, how does this go? Do you know what the pirate movie was rated? R. There you go. That's good for your kids.
Why did I not have the answer for that one? That's what's more embarrassing.
I actually have a joke that Saul wrote.
Oh, my God.
Maybe I'll save it for the fun half. I'm not going to give it away for free.
You save it for AOC.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, folks. We will see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands
up. Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.